Oh, it's great to be with you. You're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. I'm Simon Smart.
And I'm Natasha Moore.
It's often referred to as the golden rule, and most people today would accept it as a good ideal to aim for. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Treat others as you would like to be treated. Love your neighbour as yourself.
I honestly was freaking out. I felt like I had a terrorist next to me, and I'm thinking, what am I going to say? How am I going to say this? I just made sure I sent a text to my family and told them how much I love them, but I didn't want to scare anybody, but I really did think that I had a terrorist next to me.
This is Kylie Beach. She is Communications Director of Common Grace, which is a movement that seeks to connect people of Christian faith, like herself, to social justice. She was on a plane recently. Her flight was delayed, and the seat next to her was empty. The flight attendants were walking up and down the aisles looking for the missing passenger.
And they were like, oh, someone's supposed to be there, looking around all confused. And eventually they found the person who was supposed to be there, and he was sitting a few rows back. And they moved him and said to him, it's very important that you stay in your right seat. And he was the stereotype of a Muslim-looking person.
As it turns out, this man was not the terrorist that Kylie thought he was. It became quite obvious when he moved back to the seat that he was in before that he just wanted to sit next to his friend.
If he had looked different, if he had been a white woman, I would just not have even gone anywhere near terrorism. And so that's not okay. Like, where did that come from? How is it even when I'm working so hard to overcome these kinds of prejudice, are they still so close to the surface in me?
Around the same time, Kylie was working on a campaign for Common Grace that is rolling out over Easter this year, Love Thy Neighbour. Now, the thoughts she had on the plane were exactly the thoughts she didn't want to have. She jumped to conclusions because of the way her neighbour on this flight had looked.
This is exactly what the Love Thy Neighbour campaign is all about. Common Grace is releasing a series of blogs and videos about what it means to love others and how to be a good neighbour, especially if your neighbour is different or even your enemy. Over the past year or so, campaign ambassador Louisa Hope has been looking at what it means to love her Muslim neighbour.
On the 15th of December 2014, Louisa and her mother entered the Lint Cafe in Sydney's Martin Place. What happened next became known as the Sydney Siege, a 17-hour standoff between a lone gunman who had taken 18 hostages in this cafe and the police.
The siege was a very long day. It was about 17 hours. With great sadness and regret, we lost two people who were perfect strangers, but people that we'd come to love, actually. The gunman was very keen for us to get him media attention. That was his main focus. He wanted to speak to the then Prime Minister, Mr. Abbott, on the national radio, and he wanted as much media attention as he could possibly get. So that was our day. We were focused around, really around trying to get him media attention, and we figured that whilst ever we were doing that, he wasn't killing anyone.
So you've gone in for a coffee with your mum.
Mm.
The last thing you're expecting is to be in any sort of situation like you ended up in. How did you first become aware this was a terrible situation?
Well, you know, it's the funniest thing. My mother, you know, she was facing out into the cafe and I was facing towards Martin Place in the cafe. And my mother's nattering away to me. We're having our coffee and she's saying, something strange is going on over there. That man doesn't look right. Why is he here? And I'm just listening to her. Oh, Mum, you know, it's okay, don't worry about it. And being perhaps a tad dismissive of her observations. And then it became apparent that the door to the cafe was locked, that it couldn't be opened. And there was a bit of a kerfuffle about why was that. And we were then getting ready to actually go to our appointment. And I had gotten up. I said to Mum, I'll just go and pay the bill. So I went up and paid the bill. So we paid for our coffee that day, you know. The gunman was standing in the middle of the room making his speech. And, you know, you just don't believe that something like that is happening. And in my head, I'm going, this is a really bad, you know, like candid camera joke of some kind. But, of course, when I saw the gun, I realised that it was very real. And, the gun was the...
the giveaway. Mm, you knew this was serious.
That's right.
It was a really long ordeal. And you must go through so many different thought processes during that whole period. And you're dealing with tiredness and hunger and all the rest of it.
Yes.
Can you give us an idea of how your thinking changed during that period?
It was a long day, and there was what was happening in the room was actually he was giving us, this is so bizarre to even, but he was giving us toilet breaks and water and, you know, food at one stage. So that was all peculiar. He was making an effort to be showing kindness to us. So there was that happening as well as the threat that he was going to kill us. So during the day, my own thinking was just trying to stay alert and be mindful of what was going on around me and contributing in any way that I could to the group thing that was happening. What I realized, however, was that there was this thing going inside my own self in that my mind and then, of course, my spirit. When I look back in hindsight, I realized that I had that underlying and overwhelming sense of the peace of God that surpasses all understanding, which is, you know, a Christian thing. But for me, it was very real in the sense that I had a deep sense of peace, but at the same time, I was observing what was happening and my logical brain was kicking in saying, absolutely no way are you going to get out of this situation.
So when the siege did come to an end, mm-hmm. this was in the early hours of the following morning.
Yes.
The police stormed the cafe, and in the chaos and the gunfire, as you say, two hostages were tragically killed.
Yes.
Three others were wounded, and you were one of those
yes.
who was wounded.
Mm.
How were you injured?
Well, I was injured. I took shrapnel to my left leg, my left foot actually, and also I took shrapnel into my belly. So the wound on my foot was quite substantial. In the craziness of the moment, I really thought I had lost my foot. But, you know, thank goodness that wasn't what has happened.
And that still affects you today, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. It has certainly taken a long time to heal. I was in hospital for 3 months, and it certainly has compromised my broader health and capacity to kind of get around and not fall over. Mm. But, you know, you just keep going.
And you had a surprise visitor in hospital in the days after the siege, didn't you? Can you tell us about who came to see you?
Unexpectedly, a friend of mine said to me that a work colleague of theirs had asked to come and see me, which is a bit, you know, random. He explained to me that his work colleague, his name was Muhammad, and he was a Muslim man, and he wondered if he and his family could come and visit with me. So, you know, I was surprised. But I thought, well, hey, you know, if Muhammad's willing enough, and I thought that was pretty brave, you know, I'm a random stranger yeah. and after all that had happened. So I said, yeah, sure, please bring Muhammad. And so he brought Muhammad, and there was a few of us in the room that day, and Muhammad come with his young son, and he brought flowers, and he just stood at the end of my bed. He was obviously a bit nervous maybe, and so was I a bit, you know, how do you respond? And the first thing that Muhammad said to me was, sorry, he said, I'm sorry, Louisa, this man could not be a true Muslim to have done what he did. And so I said to him that I couldn't speak for all the other hostages, and I don't, but I said I could speak for my mother and I, and I said to him that we understand completely that anyone who professes any kind of faith could not have done what he did, and that we hold no grudge against ordinary Muslim people, and that I wanted him to take back to his community that we respect Muslim people and that we wished him well. And then he left, and it was kind of a really lovely visit, and I'm so grateful that he did come.
It sounds like a really powerful experience of finding common ground and choosing peace.
Yeah, it was just that, actually. You know, there was a few of us in the room, and when he left, we reflected on that, actually, thinking, how can we bring this to the broader community? He's just an ordinary guy. He's a techie, you know. He's doing his job and looking after his family, and he came with good intentions, not bad. So I hope that we can give that back as well.
in the days and weeks after this, the sort of the people of Sydney really came together in a quite amazing way. There's all that incredible scenes of the flowers being brought to Martin Place. I think that's a really lasting memory of this whole thing. And this sense of sort of solidarity and that as a community that we'll sort of get through this together.
Yeah.
What was that like for you to see that kind of response as opposed to what perhaps you might have feared might happen?
Oh, I cannot tell you how overwhelmingly relieved I felt when friends were coming and telling me, because I had put myself on a media blackout. Friends were telling me what was happening in Martin Place. Prior to that, when I was going down for my first surgery in the early hours of the Tuesday morning, I was overwhelmed with that sense of our country being on a knife edge and that we could go either way here. Worst case, you know, we could have race riots in the street or, you know, anything could happen. And I was really concerned and distressed about that possibility. So when I am back on the ward and they're telling me that there was the Ride With Me campaign so that Muslim women could be helped and feel safe on public transport, and then, of course, the arrival of flowers, I just felt so relieved. Oh, I can relax now, you know, and not be so busy about worrying about that.
Now, you mentioned earlier a sense of your Christian faith. You're a Christian person. What difference did your faith make to you in terms of the way you've processed this event and dealing with what was really a traumatic experience?
Yeah, it was pretty full on. I think that for me, my faith is that thing that I have in my life that is absolutely, it undergirds and underpins everything that I do and everything that I am. You just live your ordinary everyday life. And, you know, ordinary everyday life for me was pretty ordinary. But when you have that part of your life, that spiritual aspect to your life, which is just for me, it's about meditation and prayer and community life. When they're part of your ordinary everyday, when something goes seriously wrong in your ordinary everyday, those things are still there. And so therefore, you continue in what you know and the things that you have. So in the cafe that day, the first place and the most automatic place was for me to pray. So I'm praying like a crazy thing all day. And also, though, being aware that I knew that if I had been on the outside instead of the inside of the cafe, I would have been praying for the people inside. So I felt the comfort of knowing that I was sure that other people were praying for us.
How's this experience changed the way you relate to others, and particularly your Muslim neighbour? I know this is a particular interest of yours.
Yeah. Well, I guess in our city and in our country now, we know people from all over the world. And I come from originally from Irish Catholic tradition, and I grew up in a very small country town. So we didn't know many people who were different. But of course, my mother and my father always encouraged us to be friends with everybody. When it comes to living in Sydney, which is so multicultural, and where we work and where we enjoy our sport and recreation, you know, Muslim people are part of that, part of our broader community. And I have friends who are Muslim people. Has it changed my relationship with them? Well, no, because it was always a good relationship. But yes, it's actually made it better. I think perhaps I'm more mindful now and more aware. I was at a multicultural Harmony Day event just recently that the Premier hosted, and what I was struck by there was the amount of people who came up to me, so many people being Muslim people, so many Muslim women actually, who came and sat with me for a few little minutes, and they shared, and some of them cried, and we all ached about the fact of this horrible thing that's happened to our city, because it has happened to all of us, not just myself and my fellow hostages, but to our whole city. And I think that they felt that too. And particularly for them, I imagine the fact that this gunman professed that he was a Muslim, which, you know, culturally he may have been. I guess I'm more mindful of my Muslim friends, especially my girlfriends who wear the headscarf and things. I think, oh, I hope you're safe out there.
Louisa, it's very striking, I think, probably for everybody listening to you, how graciously you speak about this whole experience. Now, you've become involved with this Love Thy Neighbour campaign.
Yes.
Can you tell us what's the aim of that campaign and why did you become involved?
Well, actually, I'm quite excited about this, you know, because I'd followed Common Grace for a long time because of their social justice focus. So when I had the opportunity to speak with some the folks from Common Grace, and we talked about how do we love our neighbour and the whole idea of this Love Thy Neighbour campaign, it's such a cliche, isn't it? You know, love your neighbour. Yeah, sure, right. But we don't actually live it. So I guess this is a time when I'm trying to say, come on, let's really think about this again. Let's think about it in a new way. And how do we bring real love for our ordinary, everyday neighbours, be it the man in the taxi or our next door neighbour or someone, you know, across the other side of the suburb. Let's purposefully love our neighbours. And when we switch that on in our hearts and in our lives, I believe that that will liberate our neighbourhoods and our city to be something that's truly quite unique. And I'm looking forward to seeing the results of people becoming deliberate about love.
It's a beautiful vision. Thank you so much for speaking with us today, Louisa.
Thanks for having me. Cheers.
As Easter approaches, Common Grace is ramping up their efforts to engage people in this campaign. So here's Jessica Smith, Operations Director at Common Grace.
I'd love people to come out with a really kind of a renewed sense of I want to have a generosity of spirit towards those of difference, and I want to go in open, ready to love and have a sense that I have something to offer in my friendship and my offer of friendship. And imagine in Australia and a, you know, nation where that was the tone, the quality of Australians. Let's make that what our future's about. Yeah. You know, a real generous place.
If love thy neighbour is the golden rule that we can aspire to any time of year, then why is it important to pull focus towards this during Easter? To join these two ideas together, here's Kanishka Raphael, who's the Anglican Dean of Sydney.
The events of Easter, the death and resurrection of Jesus, are the climax of the gospel. God's plans for humanity come to their apex when Jesus dies for sin on Good Friday and then is raised to new life. Loving your neighbour is a fruit of the gospel in the lives of those who have encountered God's grace in Jesus. And I think that works in a couple of ways. The first one is that when Jesus dies for sin, he dies for us, and the New Testament reflects on this by saying, put your old self to death. Our self-centeredness, our self-protection, our self-promotion are put to death. The penalty for those things is paid when Jesus dies on the cross. And so as those who live having encountered God's grace in the cross, we are to put those things to death. That's the negative side, if you like.
Yeah, that sounds a bit frightening to me, put a big chunk of yourself to death.
Yeah.
Because you're someone who thinks this
so
is
I didn't
a
get
life
to the positive
giving
side.
Thing, right?
Exactly. Okay, so that's Good Friday. Now, Easter, resurrection, again, for the person who encounters God's grace in Jesus, living the Easter life is the new life that Christ puts into us. In fact, by the power of his Spirit, enables us to live this new life. That is a life of other-centeredness, a love that prefers the interests of others to your own interests, a life that serves others rather than serving self. So for the person who lives on the other side of the death and resurrection of Jesus and who has united themselves to what Jesus has done through faith, these things happen. Self-interest is put to death. Concern for others is given life and power.
Kanishka, you're the first Anglican Dean of Sydney to come from a non-European background. So you were born to Sri Lankan parents. You come from a Buddhist background.
Yes.
Have you had experiences of racial prejudice and people responding to you in ways because you're different from them?
Yes. I think in my experience, I came to Australia as a child in the 1970s. We lived initially in Croydon, and in Croydon there were populations of Greek and Lebanese people, so we knew there were other people around who were not Anglo-Saxon, I suppose. And then I grew up in Carlingford and Castle Hill, which was pretty Anglo-Saxon, and I think at my high school, certainly in my year, I was the only non-Anglo. And I don't think that I experienced any memorable or protracted incidents of prejudice. But I think what happens is when you're a stranger in another country, one, everybody who looks at you can tell that. And so people often respond to me with a certain amount of uncertainty until they hear me speak. As soon as they hear me speak, they kind of relax. So growing up, you learn that. You learn that people feel a bit nervous about you, and you learn to put them at ease. So I think you take into yourself a need to be acceptable and to be approachable. And so you learn how to do that, and you learn that it's important to do that because otherwise people are going to get you wrong. I certainly remember feeling as a younger person, I didn't want to do anything wrong because I didn't want to think that people with brown skin were unreliable or untrustworthy or something.
It's a lot of pressure on yourself too.
Well, yeah, I think that's quite a common experience for a migrant. And it's not exactly racial prejudice, but it's being aware that you're different and that you can't assume that people accept you or understand you.
So does that influence the way that you approach the role that you're in now? You're in a very multicultural area. Does that change how you be dean?
Sure. Well, I think before it has to do with me being dean, it has to do with me being Christian. A person who's reoriented by God's Spirit to think of the other before myself. I know what it's like to be a migrant, and I know what it's like to feel that people may not trust you or like you or something like that. So I want to see the Christian community anticipating the fears and needs of newcomers to Australia in order to serve them. And that's not to do with the fact that I myself was a migrant to Australia. I think that's to do with the Spirit of Jesus giving birth to an other-centeredness in people, which allows them to say, I want to serve you. What do you need most? How can I do that?
You've been listening to Life and Faith. If you enjoyed this episode, then why don't you subscribe to our podcast on iTunes? You can just type Centre for Public Christianity in the search box to find us. And while you're there, let us know what you think by leaving us a rating or review.
Next week, we'll be looking at what it means to disagree well. We'll see you then. Happy Easter.